Hello, I'm Marjorie Wingrove, your host of Death Happens, broadcast through the facilities of Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF. I've created this show as a way to normalize the conversation around death-related topics. Death is inevitable for every living thing. I believe knowledge and preparation can create some comfort and peace of mind. My guest this week is Brian Nazimok, and he has chosen this song by Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Here is And When I Die.
Satan, don't want to die uneasy, just let me go naturally, and when I die, and when I'm dead, dead and gone, there'll be one child. In a world to carry on, yeah.
Canadian Comedy Award recipient Brian Nazimok has been telling stories from an early age, a talent he primarily used in those days to get out of trouble. When he was 10, Brian went to live theater for the first time, which inspired him to pursue his dream. But instead, it led him to an unusual career, appearing in over 30 operas and nearly 300 performances without uttering a word. Canada's foremost operatic mute went on to a career in stand-up comedy as one of the earliest featured performers at Yuk Yuks. He is an award-winning television writer-producer with shows ranging from Sesame Street to the Giller Prize, and was ninth runner-up in CTV's Thrill of a Lifetime Male Beauty Pageant. His life experience as a mute performer led to the creation of an acclaimed one-person show. Welcome, Brian Nazimok.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we go back to, what, 2012?
Oh, how do I know? Yeah, whatever you say.
It was the autumn
before we went to the UK together to do the solo festival in Totnes, Devon.
You knew you were in good shape when you get off the train and they have t-shirts that say Totnes Twinned with Narnia. Oh, it's going to be an adventure, isn't it?
It really was, including out people walking their pet owls on the high street. And
they dressed up twice a week and sell each other the same things they sold each other the week before. It was fabulous.
The market. That's
right. Yeah, the market.
The medieval market. That's right.
I got a mug that said Totnes on it. The greatest find, though, the greatest find for me were orange chocolate Kit Kats. Let me tell you, if you can get an orange chocolate Kit Kat, and I went in London, I went to these specialty stores. And what are you talking about? I go to the supermarket. There are four bars there. I brought back like 18 bars of orange Kit Kat.
We have a lot of stories from that. But the most relevant thing as far as this show goes is that the solo festival took place in a bereavement center and funeral home. And
I didn't know what a bereavement center was. I went, oh, what is this?
Yeah.
And then I looked into the freezer. I went, oh, bodies. I know what a bereavement center is. We were performing, and the next day they'd wheel the bodies out and send Seamus on his way.
I did not look in the freezer, but it was a beautiful center. These beautiful stone walls. It was a pretty great place to perform.
It was a very odd building because I don't know if you remember, the lighting was terrible. I had to set that up on the floor. I became technical director. It was, but the people were interesting. I'm not sure where you were billeted. I was billeted at a hippie commune with a guy who I think he had a flowery name. I forget that. And as I explained to people, I was at a F&F, a floor and futon. There was a mattress or a futon on the floor. I'm lying there. There's no curtains. And the first morning, the sun's coming in and I wake up to look out at this beautiful morning and my host comes out in the nude, embracing a tree, smoking a joint.
Yeah. My billet wasn't that colorful. Very kind, very nice.
Yeah. But you know how I described it, and it's very interesting. I described it this way, and then I went to see a show that Trace Aaron Smith, who started Solo Theater, S-O-U-L-O.
Yeah.
And she actually had this line in the show talking about Totnes. And I said Totnes was 5 hours and 4 centuries away from London, England.
That's right. Oh, that's really accurate.
Yeah.
So I would love to get to your stories, Brian.
I do love storytelling. And when you told me about the show, I realized that for many of us, I think most of us, we don't understand death in an early age. I mean, I read about it in Sherlock Holmes shows. I watched Godzilla stomp on a lot of people and kill them. But I didn't understand death until it really hit home when I was 14. I should explain my family. My dad worked a lot. He was a lawyer. My mom helped out in the house and was involved in the community. My older sister I looked up to, who was an actress. My brother, he was the middle child, but we got along pretty well. And then there was me. There was five years difference between Joel and myself. When I was 12, we had a paper route. In those days, the Globe and Mail had a Bulldog edition, which was a paper that came out at 9:30 in the evening, which was like the first edition, and then they came out in the morning. And Joel and I would deliver the Bulldog edition to the 5 apartment buildings around the house. And we did that Sunday night to Friday night with Saturday off. And everything was going swimmingly for the first 4 months until Joel met Bonnie, his first ever girlfriend. And he decided to give up the paper route in order to spend time with Bonnie, which in retrospect was a good idea because they've spent 55 years together. So I wasn't going to do it by myself, but my dad stepped in. My dad was my best friend. He developed my love of sports, my love of science fiction, and my love at that point of wanting to be a lawyer, which changed, but that's another story. He would go to the work on Saturdays, because that's where he took care of clients who worked full-time during the week. And I'd go with him on Saturday mornings to do my homework, but mostly daydream. And I'd picture the door, which would eventually say Nazimok and Son, attorneys at law. And I would come home from school, and many days I'd phone him because he would work late just to check to see if he's going to be home on time. And I remember this one day specifically, it was March 5th. I was 14 years old, and I got home from school about 4:30, and I phoned him to remind him that one of our favorite movies, The Day the Earth Stood Still, was playing on WKBW Channel 7 during dinner hour, and that my brother, my uncle, myself were going to be in the den on TV tables eating Swanson's TV dinner, the beef TV dinner, the ones with the potatoes and the green peas and that wonderful brownie. And I tell him that we'd have his dinner ready. And he said he was going to be a little late because he needed to do some more work. He wasn't feeling that well. He lay down on the couch, but everything was fine. And I said, I'll see you when you come home. And he said, I'll see you. And we're in the den watching the film. And I hear my dad come in. And he doesn't walk into the den to say hello. He goes upstairs into his bedroom. And he never comes down. He dies right in the house. Death so very close. And I was stunned. I really didn't know how to approach this. And maybe for the next couple of days, I really didn't know where I was. Now, in Judaism, you get a body in the grave almost immediately. So our funeral was Friday at 11 a.m. And I spent more time looking around in the synagogue to see how full it was, because it seemed, wow, people found out really quickly about that death. My father was very well known, and the synagogue was packed. Instead of looking forward at the open casket, I was looking behind me. And one of the most vivid memories was as we're driving into the cemetery, and the three policemen who were on their motorcycles guiding all the traffic through, they were there saluting the hearse as we drove by. And this really was powerful for me. In Judaism, there's something called Shiva, where for 7 days you stay at home, people bring in condolences and food. And for first 4 days, I was stoic. I was that brave young man. And then on the fourth day, sitting next to my uncle's very attractive girlfriend, I just broke down and I cried and cried and cried for hours on end. But that wasn't going to be the last that death hit so close to home so quickly. In September of that year, one of my best friends who lived a street away, Stephen Mador, he was on his bicycle going down this big hill in Toronto at St. Clair and Spadina, and he had no helmet. You didn't wear helmets in those days. He went flying off his bicycle and he died. And then on Christmas Eve, my next door neighbor, the little girl I babysat for, died in a car crash. And death hit home, and it changed me. It changed me profoundly. I think it still has affected me, because after that point, I wouldn't let people get close. I put up those barriers. There was that amount of snappy patter I got through to people, but after that, there was that barrier, because I knew people were going to die on me. I knew people were gonna, I knew I was going to die. I was flesh and blood, and it also really affected my relationship with my mom, because we'd been very close. My favorite thing was we would do half past kissing time to kiss again till I was at least 12. But my mom and dad had been having problems before he passed away. We'd gone to counseling, and there was talk of divorce. And even though I loved my mom, I wanted to be with my dad. That was my choice. And my mom and dad were so separated that my dad moved into my bedroom to sleep with my brother, and I moved into her bedroom to sleep with her. And I thought she put us between us, and I thought she maybe caused some of that stress. And so when he died, for me, a lot of that relationship died. And it wasn't until, well, I'll say my early 30s, because I want to seem like I'm younger than I am, that I met the woman who would break through, Vivienne. And that, there were some problems. I describe it as guests who'd coming to Seder, and a lot of the family weren't into mixed marriages. But my mother finally saw through that, and maybe that helped the bond. And maybe opening up to Vivienne helped me relate more to her and people. In fact, when Vivienne was singing at a showcase in New York, I flew my mom down. My mom and I went to a Broadway show. We went to a baseball game, and everything was really great. In fact, I decided that Vivienne was the one and I was going to get engaged. My mom said she'd go and look for an engagement ring with me. And it was a Sunday night. for the first time in 7 years, Viv and I were going away on a Monday. We were going to Mexico. On a Sunday night, Viv and I went to my mom to say goodbye and bring over some steaks for the freezer, because a week later we were going to have Shabbat dinner there. And I said goodbye to my mom. And Monday we got to Manzanillo, Mexico, to a really not great resort. I think maybe 1.6 stars. No real beachfront. They had two paddle boats. That was the water experience. And finally, on the Thursday, it was April 6th. Finally, Viv and I got, April 5th, Viv and I got down to the beach in time to get one of the two paddle boats. The other paddle boat was housed three women, two mature women and one younger woman who seemed like she was maybe challenged. And before we went out, the head of water sports, who I also think was the doorman, he said, "Watch out, don't go straight ahead to that big rock, which is about 2,000 feet away. Go to your left, go to your right, but don't go near the rock." We said, fine. Viv and I go to the left, the women go to the right. We're paddling, paddling, paddling. It's going to be about 11:30 in the morning. I noticed the sun's getting high up. I said, let's get back. I don't want to be out in the sun. We're paddling back. And I notice near that rock we're not supposed to go to is an overturned boat and three women in the water waving. And being the bright, chivalrous man that I am, I paddle over to help the women. I jump in the water, and being the stupid person I am, I didn't realize there's undertow, which is starting to move me. But thank goodness, we gather up the women and we get to the beach on the other side of the rock, and we're waving to the people at a resort to come over. And they get in a motorboat, and two guys drive over, and they bring all the women back. And one guy stays to paddle back the women's boat, and I'm paddling back our boat by myself in the hot, hot, hot sun. And I finally get back, and I'm exhausted, and I'm hot, and I go up to our room, and we relax, and everything's fine. And then at 4 o'clock, we go downstairs for Aqua Minerale to tell my story about being this brave hero. And we're going back to our room about 6:15, 6:20, and I start to shake because of the heat. And I shake again. I get into the room. I shake under the covers and I stop. Everything's fine. We go now, we have dinner. It's games night afterwards. And Viv and I win the pass the balloon between your body contest, which we hadn't practiced at home, but we were very good at. We get a pot of tequila. We go back to the room. The phone's ringing. As I get to the room, I pick it up. They say there's a long distance call for me downstairs. I go, okay. And I go downstairs and I pick up my phone. And it's my brother, Joel. I go, hello. He goes, hello, Brian. I go, hello. Dead air. My sister takes the phone and says, Mom passed away. First question, how did it happen? She had a heart attack. Second question, have you talked to the rabbi? Yeah, the funeral's Sunday. Third question, how's the dog? Which should have been the first question. I'm sorry, but that was the third question. The dog's fine. Her boyfriend's taking care of the dog. And in fact, there's money in the will for the dog. So everything's fine. So the next day we fly to LA, but we missed the overnight flight. I'm still very stoic. I haven't broken. We fly to Toronto, we get to the airport, we come through the airport. No one was ever in my life waiting for me at the airport until this time. And that was my uncle Sid, who I was very close to, and I just broke. I just broke, it finally hit home. And then I got to say something at the funeral. And then at the Shiva, I found out something very interesting. The hour that my mother died, maybe almost to the minute, was when I was shaking in Mexico. Are we just blood and bones, or is there something more? I still don't know what death is about, and people can figure it out for themselves.
Brian, thank you. Those are amazing stories. Just, I love hearing you tell stories, for one thing. But there is that sense of connection when somebody dies. I think a lot of people experience that when they're distanced from their loved one who dies, that they get the sensation, they know that something's happened on some plane.
Yeah. Just quickly, after Viv and I split, she got lovely parting gifts. I started to take care of my next door neighbor, this elderly woman. Mm-hmm. And when Viv left the house, she took our dog Schmutzy over to this woman who couldn't say Schmutzy, would go, come here, sweetie. And even when I stopped working at YTV, I would take Schmutzy over during the day, even if I was working at home, because this woman, Bernice, really loved having the dog in the house. Well, while I was away, Bernice went looking for me one day, and she ended up having her own stroke and ended up going to East General. And when I got home, I was, you know, I was in charge of her, taking care of her. And she's in East General, and Schmutzy is pining for Bernice, cannot see Bernice. And Schmutzy's kidneys start to fail. And a week later on a Friday, I'm holding Bernice's hand. Well, she passes away. And the next day, Schmutzy passed away. All three of us at the funeral talked about her and her bond with the dog. I even put a picture of Schmutzy in the coffin with her. But there was that bond there. Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm just taking all that in.
Yeah, well, Vivienne used to talk about retiring. Fabulous, fabulous voice, just amazing. And my line was, the day I retire is the day they close the box and give me a computer in case there's internet. One of my favorite thing I think about is, there's a music called Zorro, and the opening song begins, life is what you do while you're waiting to die. This is how the time goes by. And I don't think so. I think you fill that time. You don't let it go by, because you never know what's coming up next.
I believe that's exactly right too. And the reason I'm so fascinated by death and dying is that it is what informs us how to live.
It should. I don't think it informs that many people. You know, I mean, how isolated are we until it hits really home? I mean, we can watch a plane crash, we can watch a natural disaster, but we don't let it affect us until it's upstairs or across the street or around the hall. I mean, it's a sobering thought. I mean, when I think about at this age all the people who have died, it's like, oh, you know, and I try to think about what they've given me and what I've given other people, if that's what it's all about.
I just find it's a reminder to keep seeking joy and living in joy. And you know, we're put on earth in this form, in this human form, to do something with it, and not to fritter it away, and to love each other. And
it's interesting. I say to people, go on.
No, I was going to, it just really is a gift. Our lives are a gift.
People don't realize, I say to people, you can call me lucky, you can call me blessed. Even though I had all those things happen to me, I think it made me a little stronger. It also made me approach the life the way I did. And I've been very fortunate to live my dreams to an extent. One story I've been working on, which I just did in India. There was storytelling show based in India. I don't know how I got on it. And the premise of many of my stories, I believe, is influenced by The Queen's Gambit. If I don't know if you've seen that on Netflix. It's a story about a woman who finds herself by playing chess.
I have.
I realize people travel the world sometimes like pieces on a chessboard. If you think about them, if you play chess at all, whenever there's an obstacle in the way of the king or the queen or the bishop or the castle, if there's something directly in their path from where they want to go, they have to stop. They cannot get around it, even though they can move all over the place. If it's directly in their line for where they want to go, they can't get around it. I've traveled my life pretty much, I believe, as a knight, because my goals have been kind of weird or interesting. And I've never been a direct line, and I've always been able to jump over or evade obstacles. When I was 10, I went to a place called the O'Keefe Center for the first time. I looked on the stage and went, I want to be on that stage. The fact it seemed I had no talent really wasn't going to stop me. My public school teachers let me know I was not that great a performer with roles like A Boy, Policeman Number Two, and a pirate. So that goal didn't seem like I was ever going to get on the O'Keefe Center stage. So I took a 2-year sabbatical at community college, and then I went to University of Toronto to keep out of the workforce. And I saw an ad for something called the UC Follies. The UC College Follies had been the beginning for people like Wayne and Schuster and Lauren Lipowitz, who you know as Lauren Michaels from Saturday Night Live. I went, this is it. This is my chance. I'll do this. I'll be discovered. Unfortunately, the show was so bad it closed during dress rehearsal. At intermission, Marty Goldberg comes back and says, we're not putting this in front of people. We finished the show, and at the end of this guy, Elias Aru, who's the head of the Canadian Opera Company, extras, comes backstage because he wants supernumeraries, people who play atmosphere in the background of operas, because there's people who don't sing. They carry out dead bodies, they're servants. And he approached me, and as I explained to him, my knowledge of opera is solely based on Warner Brothers cartoons, you know, The Bunny of Seville and Killed a Wabbit. And he said, well, okay, I thought you might want to do this. It plays the O'Keefe Center Stage. How did I get to the O'Keefe Center Stage? By playing Tree in Burnham Woods and stuff like that. 2 steps forward, 1 to the side. It happened the same way with my film career. It happened the same way when I met Vivian. Throughout my life, I've always made those kind of moves. And that's the stories that I'm working on right now.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So it says to me to people, you know what? Become a knight. Jump over it. Jump around it. Don't be stopped by it. Don't be worried about failure. We all fail.
Yeah, it's a beautiful image, that knight going around the world, not letting anything stop him.
Yeah. Well, death will stop me, but who knows when that's happening.
Well, and there's a bit of Monty Python in your knight.
Right? Yes. Always look on the bright side of life.
So what are you working on right now?
Well, I'm part of Storytelling Toronto. I'm on the board, and we're looking to find a storytelling center. So I'm working on that. I have a monthly show called But That's Another Story, which is on the first Sunday of every month on Zoom. We started at a place called Free Times Cafe in Toronto, and then we moved in April of last year on Zoom. And it's been really great because we've been able to get people from around the world to perform on it.
Thank you, Brian Nazimok. We really had fun getting together for this interview. We talked for nearly 2 hours. Clearly, Brian is going to have to come on the show again. So his monthly show, But That's Another Story, can be found online. The next one is February 7th. I'll end today's show with a song from Pirates of Penzance called Better Far to Live and Die. This is Death Happens, and my name is Marjorie Wingrove.
Oh, better far to live and die under the brave black flag I fly than play a sanctimonious part with a pirate head and a pirate heart. Away to the cheating world go you, where pirates all are well-to-do. But I'll be true to the song I sing and live and die a pirate king. And it is a glorious thing to be a pirate king. I am a pirate king.
You are a pirate king.
And it is a glorious thing to be a pirate king.
It is a pirate king.